Shalom and welcome to On the House, the podcast where industry experts and professionals discuss real estate in Israel. I'm your host, Debbie Goldfischer, real estate agent, founder and editor-in-chief of buyitinisrael.com. Join us as we explore market trends, legal and tax issues, purchasing tips, neighborhoods throughout Israel, and much more. All this is On the House, helping you make the right move. Welcome, everybody, and thank you for joining us once again on the House. We are now nearing the end of our fourth season, which has focused on Israeli real estate taxes and tax planning. Throughout the season, we've covered taxes related to the purchase and sale of real estate, inheritance, and rental income. I was actually looking forward to taking a little break for the Chagim, but at Buyit in Israel, we have been inundated with questions and inquiries from our listeners and friends about these topics. In particular, I've noticed a strong interest in Mas Rechisha, the tax that applies when purchasing property in Israel. So today, before we officially close the season, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to offer a bonus episode dedicated to Mas Rechisha. I'm delighted to welcome back for part two, the one and only Yair Givati. Yair, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me again.
Such a pleasure. It's great to have you here again. It feels like a deja vu. And thank you for coming to Modi'in.
It's my pleasure.
I won't go through the whole introduction again. For those of you who have not listened to the first episode on Mas Rechisha, I encourage you to check it out before diving into this one. Now, as I mentioned, we've received many questions from our listeners after Yair's last episode, and I want to address as many of these as possible in the next half hour or so. This topic is crucial, especially for buyers, particularly those planning to make Aliyah, who want to benefit from the recent amendments. So Yair, let's get started. The first question came from Daniel, who is in Boston. Daniel asks, does a Toshav Chose receive the same benefits as an Oleh Chadash? Before you answer this question, can you explain to our audience what a Toshav Chose is?
So a Toshav Chose is somebody who either made Aliyah or one of the parents were Israeli and they moved back to the US or wherever it is, in this case, I guess Boston. They've been living outside of Israel for quite some time and they want to come back. And the question basically relates to, do the Toshav Chose, somebody who's a returning resident, gets the same benefits as an Oleh Chadash?
Great. Okay.
So it's not a clear-cut question, and a lot depends on the time they've been outside of the country. In general, if the rule of thumb that I've been told by the tax office, if you've been out of the country for 10 or 15 years or more, then you should be eligible to get those rights. But sometimes we have to fight to get those rights. It's not something that they will always give it right away, and you would have to go through certain bureaucracy to show that you've been not living in Israel for quite some time. You know, as I'm sure everybody knows, the tax office is not happy to give out tax benefits which take away from the taxes. So sometimes it's a bit of a struggle to get those back from them and to show, and you have to get different documentation to show that you actually detached your connection with Israel. So for example, if you've been continuing paying Bituach Lomi all these years, then might say you've been continuing, so you'd have the connection in Israel. You know, I have clients who literally stopped any connection, any banking, any money outside in Israel just to make sure that they disconnect from any relationship, so the tax office will not have any claim against them. It's something that is not 100% clear cut. You know, like when we discussed last time, you know, if you make Aliyah within 2 years, for example, you are able to get benefits. And when it comes to Toshavim Chozrim, it's more delicate. Sometimes you have to have a bit of a struggle and back and forth with the tax office to get the rights.
Sure.
But of course, if you've been out of Israel for 2 or 3 years, you're not going to be eligible to do it. If it's a longer term, 15, 20 years, then it'd be much easier to get it. In between, they're not really giving us a number or how many years you've been outside of Israel to tell you, okay, if it's less or more, that's, you know, the defining cut.
So you defined a Toshav Chose as somebody who either made Aliyah or was born in Israel and went to Chutz La'aretz.
There's something called Katin Chose. Sometimes,
okay,
you know,
it's,
which is very, very, very similar.
Somebody who was born in Israel and then left
with his parents when he was still a katin. A katin is an underage, someone who's under 18.
A minor.
If they want to move to Israel, do they get Aliyah's benefits as olim? But they have a tudat zot, so they're not going to get olim. And then it depends on when they move to back to Israel. When is the tax office defines as the date of movement back to Israel and the detachment from Israel?
So the answer really is, it depends.
Very Jewish answer.
But it's possible.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. We have been able to get to Toshavim Chozrim and to the lower tax rates also as an olim.
Okay, great. The next question we have is from Josh in Ramat Bet Shemesh.
Close by.
Close by, that's right. Josh asks, as an Ole Chadash, if I signed a purchase agreement before August 15th of this year, is there any way I can benefit from the lower tax rates that came into effect after August 15th?
So the answer to that is, as opposed to the last one, which was depends, in this case, the answer is clear cut no. If you sign the agreement prior to August 15th, then the new benefits will not apply to you.
Okay. Sorry, Josh, there's your answer.
One recommendation I say, you know, especially when it comes to changes in the tax, be very careful, you know, because, you know, there have been in the past and, you know, in the last changes, which was quite a few years ago in 2014, the tax office was very meticulous in checking to making sure that people were not changing dates or anything like that. I would highly recommend don't play with the tax office. It's not worth it. Yeah, no, pay them out of money. It's not worth the headache, the risk.
Absolutely. Okay. The next question is from Anita in Johannesburg.
We're covering the entire world.
The entire world. You should only see, it's amazing where the traffic is coming from. Thank God we are reaching Jews all over the world and hopefully helping everybody along their journey.
Mitz Hashem.
So Anita asks, if an Ole Chadash made Aliyah as a minor, do they still have rights if they turn 18 within 7 years of the Aliyah date? So one second, I want to understand this question. Somebody makes Aliyah with their family, let's just say a 15-year-old with his parents and his four siblings. In general, an Ole Chadash, an immigrant, has 7 years to use the benefit. This 15-year-old is now going to reach till age 22. They have 7 years.
So it's a very good question. It's a very niche question. In general, the tax office looks at the family unit as having the benefit. And by law, a family unit is considered to be parents and any kids under 18. So if the parents made Aliyah, not each one of the parents can get the benefit. As a side note, I say that if there is a prenuptial and there's a financial separation, you could potentially have that. Mm-hmm. But if they don't have that and they act as a family unit altogether, then the entire family would be considered as getting the family rights.
Understood. But in this case, the child is turning 18 and now he is an adult and no longer part of the family unit from the tax perspective.
Right. But because they made Aliyah as a family unit and the family used Aliyah rights, then mm-hmm. it would be considered as if he used Aliyah rights.
I see.
That being said, the individual, once they turn 18, have the lower tax rate as an Israeli resident, but they might not be eligible for the Aliyah rights. And that's why we see many times that in order to try to avoid that, you see that kids, for example, 18 or close to it, would make Aliyah prior to the parents. So they'd be considered as separate units, as a separate individuals. Mm. It will not fall under the same category
really?
As a family unit. Yes.
Because they didn't come on the same flight?
Well, they take a bit of time. Sometimes, you know, a year ahead or a few months ahead, you know, so they are considered as a separate unit to the parents and not considered to fall under the family unit.
How interesting. They're looking at the date of Aliyah or they're looking at...
So the date of Aliyah is what counts, but if you look at your Tu'udat Oleh, there's something called Tarikh Kabbalat Ma'amad. When is that you received your status?
I see.
When do we look at it? Because sometimes we have people who move to Israel, for example, as an A1 visa or have been living in Israel under passport for a long time and then make Aliyah. So the Aliyah rights will not start from the day they made Aliyah. It would be from Tarikh Kabbalat Ma'amad, which is when they first entered the country.
I see.
So people who move to Israel basically, let's say, on an A1 visa.
What is an A1 visa? How would you define that?
Permanent residency.
Okay.
In a way that they don't have to leave Israel every 3 months like the regular visa. A1 mm-hmm. is someone who can live in Israel and work in Israel. They move to Israel, live for a couple of years, and then make officially Aliyah. You'll see the Tarikh Kabbalat Ma'amad, the date that they receive their status, would be 2 years earlier.
They backtrack.
Exactly.
Retroactively.
And the rights start from the Tarikh Kabbalat Ma'amad, not necessarily from the Tarikh that you made Aliyah.
Got it.
So it's very, very careful. And when we consult our clients, we ask to see the actual physical Tu'udat to see what's Tarikh Kabbalat Ma'amad? Because mm-hmm. it's not necessarily just a date you made Aliyah, and mm-hmm. the tax benefit would start running before that. So even if you move to Israel as A1 visa and not fully make Aliyah, your rights as an Ole Chadash starts to run from
that
point.
That's super important. So not to digress too much, but why would somebody move here on an A1 visa and not make Aliyah if they're a permanent resident?
Sometimes it's easier if they want to move to Israel quicker and then make Aliyah later on. Or sometimes they want to try it out and don't want to become citizens yet.
Got it.
Then they move to Israel, try it out. And if it works, they make Aliyah. And if not, they move back.
It happens
quite a lot. I actually was in touch with a client today. So now you made Aliyah. No, we're on an A1 visa for now. We're trying it out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually why people do that.
Understood. Next question is Gary from West Orange, New Jersey. which is actually where my husband comes from. And Gary asks, what rights do nachim, that's disabled people, have when purchasing property in Israel? Can parents buy property in the name of their minor disabled child?
I'll start by first saying that the fact that someone is disabled outside of Israel does not necessarily mean that automatically they will be considered disabled here in Israel. In order to do that, you have to go through the committees of Bituach Lomi, and it also depends on the percentage of disability. The percent of disability that they have to be recognized. You need to take a lawyer that specializes in the Bituach Lomi, which is Social Security in Israel, to go, and you have to go through committees and which will decide and define you as a disabled and what percentage you are in. And that's the first stage. Once you do that, there's a special rates for disabled people, which is 0.5% on the entire purchase price. So it doesn't matter if it's a small purchase or a large purchase, the tax rate is 0.5%.
And it doesn't matter who's paying for the property.
No, as long as it's for the usage of the disabled person. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had clients in the past, which they're taking care of their son who is severely disabled. So it was for the disabled living and for the parents, and we were able to get them the lower tax rate for disabled for the entire family for the purchase, as long as the disabled is living there in the apartment. Mm-hmm. With regards to parents buying the apartment in the name of a minor, so there might be a procedure you have to go through the court, because despite them being considered the natural guardians, the parents, if the money is coming out of the funds of the minor, then you have to go through the approval of the court, because in similar cases like this, or in cases, you know, sometimes of inheritance of a minor, any change that could potentially hurt the rights of the minor because he doesn't necessarily have the ability to know his rights. So such transactions have to go through the court to make sure that nobody's taking advantage of the minor.
Sure.
But if it's all natural, normal, the court would approve it. It's quite a quick process, you know, 2 or 3 months, and you get the approval, and you can definitely buy it in the name of the minor. But again, it has to be for the usage. You can't buy necessarily an investment apartment and get the lower tax rate. It's supposed to be a place where they're going to be living in.
So assuming the courts approve the transaction and taking out the money and whatever else is involved, the minor can benefit from the lower tax rate.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the whole family would benefit from it.
Well, let's say the family already owns something, but they want to buy something for the minor,
yes,
perhaps to use in the future.
Yes.
As an investment they have for them, they can.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Nobody likes to talk about these things, but in this day and age, a lot of people have been affected by the war and by acts of terrorism and been severely hurt in many ways. Are there any accommodations made for sufferers, for victims of terror, or, you know, people who've lost family in the war? Shalom Eda.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, we had such a case where parents made Aliyah shortly after their son. I mean, their son got killed at the beginning shortly after October 7th.
Terrible.
And then they decided to move to Israel to stay here. And we helped them get it. There's special tax rates for, again, same thing, 0.5%. We helped them to go through Misada Bitachon to get the rights and everything sorted out. But there's special tax rates for Mishpachot Nifgot Pulot Eiva, whether it's like soldiers or terrorist attacks that do get benefits in purchase tax. It's twice in a lifetime that you're able to use the lower tax rates for such sad instances.
Well, it's good to hear that the tax authorities are sensitive towards these issues, but we hope and pray that nobody will have to use them. And it's not a topic that we want to have to talk about ever.
Yes.
We have Seth from Woodmere. I think I know the answer to this question, but I wanted to run it by you. Seth says, can my wife purchase property solely in her name because she is Israeli and I am not? We want to use the tax benefit.
Again, it's similar to answer to what I said before. In general, they're looking at the family as a unit. And it goes basically in both directions. Mm-hmm. So if you want to buy it in the name of your wife, it's not that the husband will be able to get additional rights afterwards once he moves to Israel.
I don't think it's that he wants additional rights. I think it's that he wants to benefit from the lower tax bracket.
But usually they're not going to be that the wife is going to be living in Israel and the husband is going to be living abroad.
Right.
So in a way, they're looking at the family. As long as one of them is able to have that right, then the entire family unit can use it as well. But it goes also the other way. You know, the law specifically says about Olim Chadashim that to get the Olim Chadashim rights, you don't have to have both spouses have making Aliyah. It's enough that one of them has made Aliyah and both of them can benefit from that right.
Ah, okay. Well, that's the answer then.
Yes.
If only one has made Aliyah.
Yeah.
Then they can both benefit.
That's right.
As long as they live here.
Yes. A very interesting tax break you can have is pretty much the only time when you can have both party enjoy it is if there is a prenuptial between the spouses and they live a separate financial lives, meaning they have each their own separate bank account. If they have investment salaries, each one goes to his own account. They could have a joint account where they use money for their joint lives, but they can have different apartments, rent coming to the separate accounts, and then each one of them can benefit from the lower tax rate on different purchases. But it has to be very clear cut that there's no joint, so that they can't buy an apartment, even on one of them, and live in that apartment. Because once they live in the apartment, they're not really separated financially.
Right.
So they could have different apartments and rent apartment to live together. That's fine. But they can't live, for example, in one of the apartments that they own, because then it would look that they're not really leading separate financial lives.
Got it. Okay. And I think we have time for one more question. And we're going to look at this question from Miriam from Boca Raton, Florida. Miriam asks, what are the potential issues with buying property in a child's name? So I think we touched upon this, Yair, in the previous episode, but I want to elaborate a little bit more because this is something that I know many people think about as they are purchasing. They have a kid in Israel or somebody studying here or a kid that's made Aliyah. What are the potential issues that we have to be aware of?
So, you know, just for the listeners to understand better, the idea behind parents buying in their kid's name is that their kid has made Aliyah or became a resident and is eligible for the lower tax rates. And when it comes to such matters, there's three or four points which I'm usually telling my clients to consider. The first thing is that once a kid has owned an apartment or land to can build a house on, then they're not going to be eligible to join the Mechir LaMishtaken, which is the lottery, to get lower prices of an apartment.
It's like a subsidized housing program for people that have never owned an apartment.
So they're going to be losing their right unless they sell the apartment. And there's a freeze period of 6 years that they're not going to be able to participate in that program.
So that's basically going to eliminate their chances of getting into this program.
Pretty much. And then the other thing is, I'm telling them, once the child owns the apartment, if they want to buy, you know, they buy for the parents to live in, but then the child, if he gets married and want to buy a place for themselves, they will not be eligible to get the lower tax rates on what they want to buy. You know, I had one client who, I told him that, and he said, you know, my kid doesn't have money to buy in any case, so I'll be paying the tax
you
now.
You mentioned this, right? Exactly.
I might have mentioned last time.
Okay,
you know?
But for most people, that means you're basically taking away your child's benefit to use it for yourself.
Right.
I mean, somebody can say, okay, well, when it comes to him buying his house, I'll pay the difference, but it's not such
a... But to go around that, it becomes still a benefit for the parents, is that once the kid is ready to buy their own place, they can gift it back to their parents.
Okay.
And then the tax office looks at it still as a purchase and a sale. There's a buyer and a seller, but there are special tax rates when you're gifting property between family members. I'm not going to go into what is the family member, because you can contact me about it, but parents and kids are definitely considered family members. And then the kid can gift the apartment back to his parents. The sale is exempt from capital gains tax, meaning so the tax that would apply to the kid if he was actually selling it to the parents is exempt. And the parents would pay a third of whatever rates they're eligible for. So if they're living abroad and they would have to pay the 8% tax, they will pay 2 2/3.
I see.
If they move to Israel and are able to use the single residency right, they'll pay a third of that. If they
made Aliyah, pay a third of whatever they would have paid had they bought it from a private seller.
Right. But because the tax office wants to make sure you don't do it just in order to sell and use benefits from people, there's a freeze period. A freeze period is of 3 years if you live in the apartment, or 4 years if you don't live in the apartment, which you're not allowed to sell the apartment during the time. And if you do sell it, you'll have to pay back all the tax that you've saved on the gifting. That means the capital gains tax and the purchase tax.
Right.
So you have to know you can do it. And it's still, you know, the kid made Aliyah, use Aliyah rights, especially with the new benefits, which you pay very little tax on.
Sure.
And the parents have to pay a third of the tax, you know, on the gift. It's still a significant saving from the 8 or 10% they would have had to pay originally.
Absolutely.
And that's why they have the freeze period, to know that you can't just, you know, flip it around and use the rights whenever you want.
For the sake of saving the money.
Yeah. But the last thing that I do want to say, and this is very, very important, because, you know, even if it was bought in the name of the kid, you know, the family knows it's for the parents, it's owned by the parents. But This is like in theory. In practice, the apartment is registered in the name of the kid. So I'm telling the parents, no, that if you want to leave that apartment in your inheritance, you know, to say for the family to use, for selling mm-hmm. it, you can't because it's not your apartment legally.
We actually mentioned this in Amira Solo's episode on inheritance of real estate. Yeah. But absolutely, you have
so you can just sell it or leave in your inheritance and say, okay, you have to sell, you can't give instructions.
It's not your property to bequeath.
You can give a general guide what you wouldn't want to do it, but you can't force it to the kid to do it.
Sure.
So parents just have to know that, you know, if you buy it in their case, it's not theirs, it's the kid's apartment and it can't be left in inheritance. So it's mm-hmm. something for them to consider, especially when it comes to inheritance. We know like the biggest fights when it comes to inheritance is about money and property. So sometimes, you know, I told clients that this is a situation and they said, okay, so we're not going to do it. We don't want to cause fights between the kids later on.
It's not worth it, right?
Exactly.
A couple of other things that have come to mind when people have asked me if they, you know, if they should buy it in their property in their child's name. Putting aside all the tax issues, there are other things. So for example, let's say, God forbid, a child gets divorced. The ex-spouse can come along and say, that's his property. We have to split it. And now the property that you thought you owned in your son's name is only 50%.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, we tell people, especially if you do it and the kids are not married or even if they're married, is do a prenuptial, which is, it just could be just financial. It doesn't have to be religious. It has to be just for financial purposes. Mm-hmm. Or a postnuptial, meaning postnuptial is basically a prenuptial that you do after the marriage,
right.
But it has to be approved by the court. A prenuptial has to be just signed and approved by a notary. Because I think the idea behind is that before you get married, you know, the spouses have similar strength and power, but they're afraid that after you get married, maybe one spouse is overbearing, is more power. So they want to make sure that it's not one side that is forcing the other side to sign it. And that's why it has to be approved by the court. But once it's approved by the court, then, you know, it's secure. It goes back to the earlier question that we had, by the way, when I mentioned about the financial separation. Having a prenuptial with a financial separation can be a huge tax benefits for people because you might be eligible to use the rights twice, one for the husband and one for the wife.
Mm-hmm. Why would someone not do that then?
Because it's difficult. You'd have to really live a separate financial life. I mean, your salary goes to one account and the spouse goes to the other account. Any income that you have from rentals has to be...
Right, and all the expenses are shared and it's too complicated.
So it's complicated. If you are able to do it, and I've done it for some of the clients, it's a huge benefit. We save a lot of money on the tax and they own two apartments which they pay the lower taxes on. You know, and they sell it and buy again.
Yeah, but most people don't live in two separate apartments.
It's like, no, so in that case, they're actually renting an apartment and the apartments that they own are rented out.
Got it.
And the tax office actually recently asked me, yeah, I need to show back 3 years of bank statements to show that the money from the sale went in there or the rent went into that account. So it's tax benefit, a huge tax benefit, but it takes quite a bit to be able to live life like that. So if it's not comfortable, people sometimes don't do it. And if they do it, I think eventually, you know, after it's done at the beginning of the first few years of the marriage, but once you're quite a few years in and you want to buy a larger apartment to live in, and then, you know, that tax benefit, they just buy a bigger apartment to live in both, and then that tax benefit is gone.
Got it.
So it's usually, I've seen it done by younger couples, you know, the beginning of the marriage, but not later on in life.
Makes sense. Okay. Another potential issue, this is for Miriam from Boca, when buying a property in a child's name is if, God forbid, the child goes bankrupt, goes into financial difficulty and owes people money, the banks and the courts can claim the property from the child.
Absolutely. But it's not just if they go bankrupt or come into debt, but that's, you know, in general, the apartment belongs to the kid. If the kid is, you know, young, you know, 18, 19, 20, they're not thinking about their future. They want to go now to tour around the world. Hypothetically, it's their apartment to sell, take the money and do with it whatever they want with it. That's usually why we recommend, you know, for our clients, you know, to put a lien on the property, put a harat hazara, which prevent the kids from selling it or putting a mortgage there that, you know, in a way they will have first right, even in case of bankruptcies or debts or things like that. They have a lien on the property, so their rights comes first.
I see, right.
And they, in a way, loan the money for the child to pay it. So that's when we need to get our money back because we helped him, but then we want our money back before it goes to someone else. When it comes to bankruptcy, it could be a bit more difficult, but in general, that's the protection. If you buy in a child's name, that he's not going to, you know, as a 20-year-old...
squander the money.
Yeah. We want to travel around the world, do a world tour in the first class. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, as always, this is the same message over and over. Speak to the professionals. Don't do anything that you think might be in your interest because it could actually backfire. Make sure that you've run it by a lawyer or an expert consultant and make sure that this is in your best interest.
Understand the risks, understand, you know, the full picture, and then make the decision which is right for you. I'm really enjoying this. So as many as you want.
I got to get ready for Chag. Okay, we have something from David from Edgware in the UK. Edgware is near London, those of you that don't know. And David is asking, my son owns a property in Yerushalayim and he is marrying a young woman who is an Olah Chadasha. They want to purchase a home together. Will they be able to use the benefits as an Olah Chadasha?
Okay, so this is a great question because there are multiple answers to that question.
Lovely. What,
when you ask a Jew a question, you know, it has to be complicated. It can't be just a straight
of
yes
course.
Or no. So first of all, as we said, to use Aliyah rights, it can be that only one of the spouses has that right. So if the spouse who's making Aliyah does not own an apartment, then they will be able to use the Aliyah rights. That's the first side.
Even though you mentioned earlier, they look at the family unit.
But Aliyah rights is something that is separate, that can be applied to one of the spouses and will benefit both. It's the same question, same idea as, you know, the Israeli, why would he be able to get the lower tax rate when he's not an Oleh Chadash? So they look at the benefit that Oleh Chadash has, even if the spouse doesn't have that right.
Got it. This guy, he may have used his rights as an Oleh Chadash himself, and now he's marrying somebody, and she can use the rights as well.
Yes.
So in their household, they will have used the rights twice.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
But there's a few other options. First of all, like we said a second ago, prenuptials. You do a prenuptial, and if it's a financial separation, she can buy it and use the Aliyah rights for an apartment fully in her name.
Mm-hmm.
And the last answer, which is very interesting, is that there is a clause in the tax ordinance, in the takanot, that says that if it's spouses, that one has an apartment prior to them getting married, and now they're buying a joint apartment, so one of the spouses has an apartment already and the other one doesn't have, you can do a split calculation where, in a way, the spouse that owns an apartment already would pay the full higher tax rate, the 8 and 10%, but the spouse that doesn't own would able to get the lower tax rates on their half of the portion.
Why would someone pick that over the prenuptials?
Yeah, it depends on financial. Sometimes they will need the joint money. If it's a prenuptial, it says all the money has to come from that party's doing it. You can't have the prenuptial and then both
and then
of them putting money towards it. They're not going to get it because it has to be a
totally
financial separation.
Separate. I see.
So in this case, you are able to use that split. You might not get the lowest tax rates, but you definitely get a benefit.
Get 50% of the
exactly
benefit.
On that rights.
I
and,
see.
And you don't even have to sign any special contract or anything like that. It's something that you have to apply. We've done it in the past quite a few times, and it still saves quite a bit of money on the instead of paying the 8 and 10 full purchase tax, you pay, let's say, 4%, you know, in a way. It's not the exact calculation, but I'm saying still saving, you know, 50% of the overall tax is still quite a great
savings.
There's quite a few answers to that question of how you can still save all the tax, even if one of the spouses has an apartment prior to getting married. And
going back to the prenuptials, if a couple don't think about this before they get married, and then they're married, and now they want to buy their apartment together, and they want to benefit from separating their finances.
You can do a postnuptial.
You can do a postnuptial. That was my question.
But
okay.
Like we said, it has to go through the court. It's not a simple process.
Sure.
You have to go. The judge would ask you whether, and we've done it also, the judge would ask and find out, you know, to see, you know, why you're doing it, who did this, what's the purpose, do you understand what you're doing before they would approve it.
Sure. Yair, thank you so much. This was really, really helpful. And I hope for all of our listeners, it's answered many, many of the questions.
It's always a pleasure to come here and be on with you.
Thank you. And you never know, we might have a part three if we continue to get so many questions. But for now, we're going to wrap this up. And I must say, before we wrap up and take a break until after the Chagim, I think it's important to acknowledge the challenging times that we are currently facing. Over the past year, we have witnessed profound devastation, loss, and overwhelming pain. And the situation remains tense. As we speak, we find ourselves under attack on various fronts. As the mother of soldiers, each day presents a delicate balance of fear, uncertainty, and awe. Despite these immense challenges, I personally feel a deep sense of gratitude and blessing to be living here in Israel. And I thank Hashem for the miracles, both big and small, that we witness daily in our beloved country. There is truly nowhere else in the world that I would want to be. This land, with all its complexities, both beautiful and harsh, is our home. It's where we draw strength from our shared experiences and find a deep sense of belonging. I'm constantly inspired by the dedication and bravery of the IDF and the resilience, courage, and commitment of the people here in Israel. Together, we navigate these trying times, holding on to hope and faith for a brighter, more secure future. Before the high holidays, I want to take this opportunity to thank all my listeners for your engagement, your comments, questions, feedback, and unwavering encouragement. This fuels my passion and gives me the strength to continue doing what I do. I also want to express my gratitude to all the show guests who have graciously joined me for discussions, sharing their insights and professional knowledge. Without their participation, this wouldn't be possible. As I think you can hear, all my guests share a genuine concern and passion for helping our fellow Jews find their way home. And as we move forward, Bezrat Hashem, I hope to continue producing episodes that cover relevant topics and important issues to help you, no matter where you are in the world or what stage you're at in your journey. I wish everyone a Shana Tova. May this year bring peace, security, healing, and redemption to Eretz Israel and to the entire Jewish nation. We yearn for the safe return of our hostages. We pray for the protection of our soldiers. And we hold on to hope that all the citizens in the North and the South will soon return safely to their homes. Thank you again for joining me. Bezrat Hashem, we'll be back after the Chagim for a new session of On the House.
Shana Tova.
Thank you, Yair. Shana Tova. Thank you for listening to On the House. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and share it with your family and friends. You can also visit buyitinisrael.com, where you can find news, market updates, guidance, and much more on real estate in Israel. That's buyitinisrael, buyitinisrael.com. If you have a question or a specific topic you'd like us to cover on this podcast, please email us at the address you'll find at the bottom of the show notes. Whether you're thinking about Aliyah, looking for a home or a haven, or wanting to support the Israeli economy, now is the time to buy it in Israel.